From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
بيان صادر عن القيادة العامة للجيش والقوات المسلحة.
That was Ali Abdullah Ayyub, the chief of the general staff of the Syrian Arab Army, announcing that Syria's military had, quote, completed its mission in restoring security and stability to the city of Deir ez-Zor, entirely, closed quote. He made the announcement on television in Damascus on Friday. That city, at a key crossroad between Damascus and Baghdad, had been under siege since 2011. For more on what that means, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer in international affairs at Moscow State University, from Moscow via Skype on Friday. Okay, Mark, so it looks like this Syria thing is wrapping up pretty quick all of a sudden. Now we got Deir ez-Zor.
I think wrapping up when we're talking about Syria is a little bit early and triumphalist. Yeah. We still got the I mean, ISIS has been on the ropes for a long time, and it's been about a race for territory. But this U.S. and their SDF proxies and Al Qaeda still in the east. This race for territory and this tense situation out there with hinting at partition. The Al Qaeda firmly in control of Idlib province now. Cooperating with the Turkish military in Al Qaeda held territory, Turkey controlling a huge swath as well, plus dug in rebel redoubts in East Ghouta and Daraa. This is still a long way, but certainly ISIS is on the ropes in East Syria. Deir ez-Zor, this is a significant city because this was Syria's lifeline to hold on to the whole eastern part of the country. There were some 5,000 to 7,000 Syrian men, the majority. About 2,000 of them were regular military, and the other 5,000 were police and basically draftees.
Right.
They withheld this city for 5 years of siege.
Wow.
5 years. 2 years from Al Qaeda, which was the predecessor in the region to ISIS, and then 3 years from ISIS, and it was just Deir ez-Zor in a sea of black, of ISIS-held territory. Daily attacks on the city. It was kept alive via airdrop. The Syrian and Russian militaries kept it supplied. They held out there for 5 long, terrible years, protecting some over 100,000 civilians, and of course, we how many of them would have died if ISIS had, managed to seize the city. And not only that, but on at least 3 occasions, troops defending Deir ez-Zor came under fire from U.S. and its so-called coalition aircraft, usually either directly before or during ISIS attacks. And this is – the U.S. really wanted Deir ez-Zor to fall, because if Deir ez-Zor fell, then they could take it over either with some kind of – they hoped with some kind of cobbled-together Arab – force that they never managed to Sunni Arab force that they never managed to manufacture. They had a big problem manufacturing those moderate rebels,
right?
Or with the SDF, the Kurdish majority forces. They hoped that Deir ez-Zor would fall to ISIS, then they would be able to take it and use that, the regional capital, to partition the east of the country. But it never fell, even after this U.S. close air support for ISIS attacks. And when I say that, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, the U.S., of course, always claimed it was a mistake, but this wasn't a one-off strike or anything. These were usually 45-minute, an hour-long sustained air attacks. At one point, it cost Deir ez-Zor control of the airport, of their airport, which was helping keep them alive, and it wiped out 10% of the troops that were protecting that. So the U.S. was really playing a cynical game out there. Yeah. But 2 months ago, the Syrian army and their allies made a three-pronged attack across the Syrian desert, because this is the east of the country. It's scarcely populated, but it controls Deir ez-Zor alone controls the province, controls over half of Syria's oil. That's where it's located. They made a three-pronged assault that they eventually met 2 months ago. They penetrated the lines and were able to get resupplies into the city. They reached it, and here we are two months later from reaching the city. It has been completely cleared now of the last ISIS dug in ISIS holdouts, and the people of the city are safe. Those that garrison, God bless them. They've been relieved. And most importantly, it prevented the U.S. from using Deir ez-Zor and, the oil in the province, using that capital city as a basis of partitioning the country in the east. So there's still other dangers with Raqqa and so on, but with Deir ez-Zor so close, that was a crucial city that makes it much harder for the U.S. to do that, to partition the country. So now there's one final urban holdout. This is the twin Syrian-Iraqi city of Abu Kamal on the Syrian side of the border, and Abu Qayyim, Al-Qayyim on the Iraqi side. There's a coordinated attack from both sides. Both the Syrian army and the Iraqi army are closing in on this dual towns, that stride the border. They're both on the south side of the Euphrates. The Iraqi forces already managed to take the border crossing, and both sides are moving into position to clear that up. And then that should clear up the last urban stronghold of ISIS, and the caliphate as a territorial area in eastern Syria and western Iraq will come to largely to an end. Of course, ISIS will continue to exist both in Syria and Iraq. They'll fade into the desert. They'll join other groups. They'll become, a terrorist insurgency force. But they're also global now. I mean, aside from Syria and Iraq, they're in Yemen, they're in Afghanistan, they're in Libya, they're in the Philippines, they're all over the world now. Now, of course, the situation is the East is this tense territorial race and control of oil and gas fields between the U.S.-backed proxies and the Syrian government. And that's going to now come to both a strategic and a political head soon. The U.S., the Trump administration, continues publicly to claim that they support Syria's territorial integrity, and the only reason they're in Syria is to fight ISIS. Well, that rationale, modus operandi is coming to an end. Because with ISIS losing their last urban strongholds, the U.S. is losing its pretext for being in eastern Syria. Right. And they will have to make a decision whether they're going to push the Kurds towards partition, which I feel worse about, that it would be disastrous for the Kurds after everything that they themselves have endured with ISIS and U.S.-backed Islamists, Al-Qaeda, etc. I think that the Kurds deserve something, some type of autonomy, some type of federalism, but they have to be realistic, and they can't have their expectations too inflated by the United States and risk being used as useful idiots. We saw what fate once again befell the Kurds in Iraq,
right?
With Barzani disappearing, the goal of Kurdish declared Kurdish independence evaporating very quickly, and you know, right back, perhaps even worse than when they began a year ago. And you'd think the Kurds on both the Syrian and the Iraqi sides of the border would have learned to beware of Americans bearing gifts. we're talking already. This is the third time they've been played by the United States. So you know, I'm not a big supporter of the ideology of ethnic nationalism, the idea that every little nation on the planet deserves a state, because the creation of these ethnically pure states requires endless amounts of genocide, fratricidal warfare, ethnic cleansing, mass moves of population, because it simply doesn't occur naturally. It took hundreds of years for this to take place in Europe. You know, we're talking
huge
genocidal fratricidal war, the 100 years war, the 80 years war, the wars of Spanish secession, World War I, World War II, the Yugoslav wars, right up to the Ukrainian conflict, where it's, you know, still continuing.
Right up
it's
to Catalonia, even that, you know.
Catalonia, like,
okay. It's insane. You know, it's been real busy. You first of all, I wanted to ask you, because we haven't had a chance to speak since this happened. You know, the Barzani stepping aside happened within like a day, I think, or hours of the meeting with in Moscow with you know, so the foreign minister of Iraq and Lavrov met in Moscow, and then like within a day, Barzani's like sayonara.
Yeah, there were two large factions of Kurds in Iraq, one of them, the controlling faction, was the Barzani clan and their political party that was affiliated with them. And then there was a separate political party, the Kurdish Democrats, as they're called, that were under the Talibani. And when it came down to the crux point, when Iraqi forces, when the referendum happened, Barzani to declare independence, and Iraqi forces went in to first Kirkuk, which was outside of what was proper considered Kurdistan, which was the internal division of the country that had been agreed when you know, the U.S. removed Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq and pushed the country towards federalism. The Talibani, their political clan, their Peshmerga, they withdrew completely from their defensive positions, leaving Barzani's Peshmerga and his political party in in a completely undefendable position.
Right. In the crosshairs,
In the crosshairs, you know, this is the PUK, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, and they, as a result of that, the whole thing collapsed overnight. Kirkuk fell first. The Kurds started retreating everywhere back to, again, they had seized some extra 20% over of their own territory, 20 to 50% actually. It was a large amount of territory out what was considered Kurdish territory proper, and Kirkuk was an important city for control of oil and gas fields that would have made a Kurdish state somewhat viable, but it didn't have a Kurdish majority. It doesn't have anywhere near to a Kurdish majority. There's arguments that historically it did. They were moved out. You know, that's neither here nor there. The city was not Kurdish majority. It was not within the borders of Kurdish autonomous area. So now they risk losing everything. Barzani is disappearing, resigning in disgrace. You know, we will see probably fresh elections that are badly needed in Iraqi Kurdistan. You know, this independence movement in Iraq has come to a crashing end, a surprisingly devastating collapse of the whole movement, and the central government in Baghdad restoring authority over the country.
Yeah, you've got also some discussion going on out in the public domain now that there's some sort of a real politic acknowledgement on behalf of the Syrian government, which I actually haven't heard affirmed by them, but that there's, you know, they're going to have to accept some loss of territory. I believe it was in the north, and that one of the primary players up there is actually very heavily connected to BP, and that you know, you're starting to see not just the U.S.'s hand and the local players, Turks and the Saudis, but actually that of the U.K. looking to have its interests expressed through the partitioning of northern Syria.
Yeah, you're talking with the Kurds, the Kurdish
yeah,
area.
Well, yeah, right,
yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, there's all kinds of talk, and of course oil is a big concern and everything, and there is no final resolution. I don't think the Trump administration itself has made up its line, whether right. it's going to eventually withdraw, use the Kurds for political leverage in some kind of settlement, or push for a partition. They've muddled through, their first, not even a year yet in office. They've vastly increased military support for the Kurds, U.S. Boots on the ground. They've vastly increased all of this, but they still don't have, I think, a strategy. They are lacking both a strategy on the ground in Syria and a geopolitical strategy, because the Kurds represent a very poor partition partner, because it will alienate them from both the government that they installed in Baghdad in Iraq, all those years ago now in the invasion of Iraq, and from Turkey, which is a NATO partner and whose air bases are crucial to U.S. Geopolitical control or influence in the Middle East. And if Turkey further moves away from the U.S., upset about what they're doing with the Kurds in Syria and Iraq, it must be said, although the Turks have had their own game with the Barzani clan that they've lost out on. The U.S. really puts itself and reduces its own influence in the region. So the Kurds just do not represent a good partition partner for them. I hope that cooler Kurdish heads prevail in Afrin and elsewhere, those who aren't directly under the U.S. wing, and that some negotiation can be reached. Up till now, I think the understanding from the Russian government is that some compromise between the Kurds and Damascus would have to be reached, and that some type of federalism was Moscow's preferred pragmatic solution to this. But recently, Syrian government, with all its successes, has been pushing further to central control and restoring the entirety of the territory of the government under control of Damascus. And the rumor mill here is that Moscow at this point, because of the duplicity of the U.S. and so on, might now be willing to stop pushing the Damascus government on federalization, and right. they may be willing to back Damascus all the way to restoring control over the entirety of the territory. I think they expect the U.S. to fold at some point and just leave ignominiously, making some kind of declaration, Trump claiming he's defeated ISIS, the rest of the world laughing, and then the U.S. forces being pulled out in the middle of the night sometime and leaving the Kurds to hang. That remains a strong possibility, but again, the writing's not on the wall, and the neocons would like to push the Trump administration in a different direction, in several different directions, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at, as a matter of fact, the policy that led to here wasn't Trump's. This was the Obama administration's baby, and Trump had made it clear during the campaign that the entire program of regime change was something he did not want to get involved with.
And yeah, regime although, change, nation building,
the whole bit. Yeah, all
he
of that.
Specifically spoke against it. And all of he that. Made so many tweets over Obama's involvement
right.
in
right.
Syria, the terrorist forces, you know. So
yep.
when he made the strikes against Damascus on this pretext of a chemical weapon attack on Al-Qaeda
right.
at Khan Shaykhun and so on, he cost himself a lot of his support of his own, I don't want to say his, majority Republican support, but his strong alt-right base, and maybe right. I'm not using that, all those people wouldn't correctly identify themselves as alt-right, but a lot of his political backers, active on the internet and so on, were non-interventionist.
Exactly.
Right?
And that was a problem for them. But if you look at what has actually unfolded, you know, here's the shiny thing over here, which was that strike and the, you know, Nikki Haley blathering some nonsense at the UN, et cetera. However, Russia is, you know, going through their program, Iran and everyone, unimpeded. There's a whole lot of bluster coming out, but the U.S., in fact, is getting out of the way and letting this happen and playing, in reality, even by doing nothing, a constructive role while this gets cleaned up. And we just had Astana, the seventh round closed on Tuesday, and they've scheduled for the second half of December the next round. It's quite possible that there is going to be at least a, you know, framework of a political solution coming out soon. ISIS's back has been broken, as you said, and it's really a cleanup job at this point. If the U.S. doesn't get in the way with some stupid thing to deadlock it somewhere, this could wrap up.
Okay, first of all, I'm very suspicious about the Astana process, that Erdogan still controls a large, you know, Turkey still controls a large swath of Syrian territory himself. Plus now the Astana process, this de-escalation zones declared over Idlib, which is, even Western pundits, that are supporting of the opposition, they admit that it's Al-Qaeda controlled. You want to call it Nusra. They currently go by Tahrir al-Sham, HTS is the acronym.
They're rebranding themselves every week almost.
Erdogan has moved military forces into Al-Qaeda-controlled Idlib in cooperation and coordination with them, actually, to try and surround the Kurdish canton of Afrin. Erdogan has been in Jarablus, which is the city, the center of the territory that Turkey and its newly branded New Syrian Army proxies control. They're opening Turkish post offices,
right?
They're like branded Turkish post offices, Turkish government. They're not planning to leave anytime soon. The Sultan still believes that territory is his, historically part of the Ottoman Empire, whatever.
And Idlib is where BP, this BP person has been playing, right? So that's
Idlib,
what's going
that makes
on.
More sense.
So you've got
that
the UK working with, you know, they're using Erdogan proxy, essentially.
That's an entirely different problem with Al-Qaeda. They are firmly entrenched in Idlib, and that is a hilly, mountainous territory with a population that a large portion of it is fairly sympathetic. Foreign Affairs just ran another whitewashing piece in just over a week, talking about the moderate face of Al-Qaeda. Once again, they're trying to... That they're trying to whitewash and rebrand Al-Qaeda as the kinder, gentler ISIS. Never mind two UN Security Council resolutions that call on member states to eradicate both ISIS and Al-Qaeda, their safe havens, and any endeavor, organization, or individual that associates with either one of them. Never mind that. Once again, we're back. All the other opposition have melted away or just, become Al-Qaeda itself. They're trying to rebrand Al-Qaeda. There's some possible suggestion that Al-Qaeda could be now from Idlib redirected as a force to try to take on Hezbollah in Lebanon, which I think would be their death now. But there's still a big problem, and I don't hold much for the Astana process. But I want to point out what Trump has been up to in Syria, vice what Obama was up to.
Right.
Obama was playing a two-pronged game. The Pentagon was working with the Kurds, the SDF. That's how they rebranded them. And we've had American generals openly at security forums discuss that the SDF is just their rebranding of the PKK, you know, anarcho-Marxists. I don't have a huge problem with that, right? You know, they're secular at least. But the Pentagon preferred to work with them because they were secular, the Pentagon was tasked with fighting ISIS. This is later in the conflict, of course, because earlier ISIS and Al Qaeda were both allied with the U.S. backed FSA. That's right. When they took over East Aleppo and so on. But years later, ISIS got too big for its britches, turned on the others in fights over rents and control of territory and petty political egos, and that you had this fracturing between ISIS on one hand and Al-Qaeda and the FSA on the other. Meanwhile, Obama's CIA was tasked with supporting the so-called this brand, the Free Syrian Army, which wasn't free, wasn't Syrian, and wasn't really an army. A bunch of brigades, most of them Islamist, some of them like Al-Zinki, openly Wahhabist, and cutting the heads off of kids on videos for propaganda purposes. Mm. They were a big problem. The CIA was backing them, and I have big problems with Obama's CIA at that point. I mean, first of all, it was illegal. Secondly, they're arming, training, and paying the salaries of sectarian militants who are allied with Al-Qaeda. Quite openly, everyone, there's no question about it.
Right.
When Trump came in, as everything we know is that he ended the CIA support of the FSA and the other affiliated Islamist groups that were allied with Al-Qaeda. And, that's no small chump of change because Washington Post reported a year ago that effort alone, just the CIA to them, was at least $1 billion a year, taxpayer dollars a year.
That's right.
Now, what Trump did do then is vastly increase the money and the arms and giving heavy weapons, vehicular weapons and so on, tanks and then artillery pieces, and increase the U.S. Footprint, the military footprint in eastern Syria in support of the Kurds.
Right.
They rebranded it as the SDF. So Obama started this. Trump took it in a slightly different direction. And I'm happy at least that Trump stopped supporting the Islamists because they were, that's terrorism. That's state support of terrorism. There's a lot of people that don't consider the PKK terrorists. I'm kind of in the middle on that issue, but at least in Syria, they certainly haven't been. They've been fighting terrorists, both ISIS and it must be said, the CIA's own proxies. We had Pentagon Kurds fighting CIA Islamists for sustained periods in the last few years of this war. So, Trump has taken Obama's horrible, moralist strategy for regime change in Syria, and moved it in a different direction. And certainly the writing was already on the wall that regime change was no longer an option. But we still have Tillerson and Nikki Haley making comments like Assad's days are numbered and that he must go and so on. And you think they would have learned their lection, because the scorecards that are up on the internet of all the political leaders in the West and the GCC have at one point said Assad must go.
A million is a number two, man. If his days are numbered, a million is a number two. So it doesn't mean anything.
I mean, so many of them have either been voted out of office, removed from power, died naturally, and Assad is still there. I'm no big particular fan of Assad, the person of Bashar al-Assad. I mean, remember, I'm old enough to remember back when he was the neoliberal darling of the West.
Right, me too.
But he has held on for the last 6 years, so he deserves that at least.
Yep.
Once this is all over and elections are held, whether the Syrian people choose to continue with him or move on, that will be their decision to make. But he managed to keep the country together despite this massive Western and Gulf Cooperation Council regime change via proxy effort against him. So he deserves credit for that, at least, if nothing else.
Yep. All right, great. And we're going to have to stop there, Mark. Thank you very much. And we'll speak with you again next week and see what develops, because there's an awful lot in motion right now. Thank you.
Yeah, don't expect it to be over tomorrow. That's all I'm saying.
All right, thank you, man. Take care.
Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.